If you are new, or if this is your first week, or you just haven't been here in a while, welcome. We undertook something as a church family in the beginning of this year, January 1st. We, as a church family, began walking through the entire Bible chronologically with a goal to challenge you and encourage you to read through the entire text of the Bible this year. And so hopefully you've been doing that if you've been here a while. And as we're doing that, we're not able to focus in-depthly on one book of the Bible like I normally would do, but instead we're trying to do a flyover of the entire Bible in a year. And so because of that, we have to skip chunks, and my goal really is those chunks that we skip, I want to still explain to you what's going on, because the Bible is one story written by multiple authors over the course of thousands of years on multiple locations. But it tells one story, and even the book of Genesis itself is just one book in really a novel of five books we call the Pentateuch, or the Book of Five. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And what Moses is doing is he's telling a story within those five books itself. And so it's a little bit of a disservice to the scriptures to just take a part of it and pull it out of its context and explain it to you. And so the first week we talked about creation. We started at the beginning, God creating with his words and creating everything in existence and creating man in his image. And we learned that God creates us in his image to reveal and represent him to the world. And then we skipped ahead a little bit and we saw the creation of man more in depth in Genesis 2 and in Genesis 3. We learned about the fall of Adam and Eve. We learned about the events that led to sin and death entering into this creation that God had made. And at the end of Genesis 3, we read about the cursing of man and woman and of the earth. We read that they were kicked out of the garden, the paradise that they were in. Their relationship with God was broken. Their relationship with each other was broken. If you remember in Genesis 3, they come to this realization that they're naked and they're ashamed about that. And so their goal is to cover themselves up, to hide themselves from one another, and to hide themselves when they hear the voice of God. And so Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden. Genesis 3:24 says this. It says, "He, God, drove out the man, and at the east of the garden he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life." So God has put in a guard to make sure that Adam and Eve can't find their way back to the tree of life. And then the next story that we read in Genesis 4 is really the story of Cain and Abel. So we've skipped ahead some years. Now we have the sons of Adam and Eve after they've left the garden. And I'm sure that Adam probably took his sons with him up the ways to where the garden was. And he pointed to the cherubim and the flaming sword and said, "We used to live there. That used to be our home. We walked with God there. And we sinned, and we fell." And so we're introduced to Cain and Abel. And in an instance, if you're familiar, if you've read this, Cain gets angry, and he raises up, and he kills Abel. So in a moment, in a span of a couple verses, the fractured relationship that began in Genesis 3, that began with the realization that we're naked, that we're ashamed, that we need to hide ourselves, that we can't be intimate with another, escalates to murder. How quickly man has fallen into their sinfulness. So we read that Cain is cursed by God. Cain leaves. He becomes the father of the Canaanites. And Moses continues on giving us the generations of Adam and Eve. And if you've read that or if you've read it before, that's where it gets really monotonous, because all of a sudden you're reading that this guy begat this guy and then this guy begat this guy. And every once in a while you just got to throw in the name of a Pokemon just to kind of stay with it. And eventually we come to a guy named Noah. We have all these generations. We learn about all these guys. We learn about dudes that lived for 900 plus years on this earth, which is way too long, and we get to Noah. And hopefully you know the story of Noah. So during that time, during Noah's life, God sees the wickedness of man on the earth, and he decides rightly to judge the entire earth because of the wickedness of man. And for some reason, God chooses Noah for salvation from his judgment. God chooses Noah and his family to save. And if you've read any more of Genesis, you know it's not because Noah's really the best dude. Noah is sinful. Noah is broken. But God chooses Noah, instructs him to build an ark. And then we read that God sends rain upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. We read everything on the earth is destroyed except that which God has preserved inside of the ark, Noah, his family, and animals. And then we get to Genesis 9. And we read that after the flood had subsided, that Noah and his family emerged from the ark. And upon leaving the ark, God gives them their first commandment for this kind of restart, this reboot. And he says to them, Noah, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, does that sound familiar? He says, Noah, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And that should kind of sound familiar in the back of your head because it should immediately point you back to Genesis 1. When God creates man and woman, what's the first thing he says to them? Be fruitful. Multiply. And so in chapter 10, we really read the story of Noah's sons being fruitful and multiplying. We get more of this guy begat this guy and this guy begat this guy. And chapter 10 tells us that the nations of the world came from Noah's three sons. And that leads us into Genesis 11 and the Tower of Babel. So if you have your Bible, Genesis 11, 1 through 9, you can follow along on an app. That's all right. We're also going to put it up on the giant electronic Bibles up here. Genesis 11, starting verse 1, it says this. Moses writes, Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they made brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And then they said, Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower, which its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. These are the words of the Lord. See, this is a story that I often think is overlooked in the book of Genesis. We kind of have, if you read a children's Bible or if you look at all the children's stuff, you have the cute little pictures of God creating animals, and then you got Noah, and for some reason we make that sound really cute and playful when really it's kind of a horrible story. However, I think this story really plays an important role in our understanding of God and our understanding of really the book of Genesis as a whole. Look back with me at verse 1. The narrative starts out, Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And that might sound a little repetitive, but Moses is really trying to tell us that all of speech at this point in history was universal. And I think I can illustrate this for you in a helpful way. Me and my wife have different words for different things. For instance, I often enjoy Dr. Pepper. And where I grew up in Texas, Dr. Pepper was called Coke. My wife calls Dr. Pepper Pop, because she's wrong. We're talking about the same thing, but we have different words to describe those things. I grew up calling it Coke. Some people might call it soda. Some people call it pop. Coke is the correct answer. So our country has three different words to describe this one drink, and Moses here is telling us that everyone in the ancient world would have called it the same thing. Now God graciously gave us Dr. Pepper, so I'm sure it existed in Genesis. It doesn't. But if it had, everyone would have called it the same thing. They would have said, "Let me have some Coke." Now, if you've been reading through the book with us here, you might have noticed that there's something weird about the text. There's something weird about the scriptures here. See, in Genesis 10, we're told three different times that that the world had multiple languages. Genesis 10, Moses says three different places that the world has multiple languages. And some will try and say, look, the Bible here is in contradiction with itself. You got Genesis 10, Moses says, look, the world has multiple languages. And now we have Genesis 11, which comes right after Genesis 10. And Moses says there's only one language. The Bible contradicts itself, Matt. It can't be truthful. It doesn't work that way. But Moses is really doing something extraordinary here. Remember, Moses isn't writing just to write. He's writing down a story. He's telling the story of God, and he uses his thoughts and his mind and his style to write it. And so in chapter 9, if you remember that, Noah is given the command to what? Be fruitful and multiply in order to fill the earth. In chapter 10, we read that Noah's sons went out, they multiplied, and they seemingly filled the earth. And so you read that, and you would think here, it appears that Noah and his sons were obedient to God and his commandments. It appears that Noah and his sons were obedient to God and his commandments. It seems that humanity has learned from the judgment of God that they just went through, that they've decided to obey the commandments given by the Creator. And then Moses tells us in 11 that humanity didn't spread and fill the earth out of obedience, but that it was the result of disobedience. I think Moses does this purposefully, and John Piper agrees. He writes this. He says, Genesis 11, 1 through 9 drops the bomb on us. It wasn't obedience. They weren't spreading. They were clustering. God came down and shattered their disobedience and made their clustering impossible. He confused their language and broke humanity into many peoples and languages. I think Moses does this to say, look, be careful not to build up creation. Be careful not to build up humanity. We are fallen sinners. Genesis 11, as John Piper wrote, drops the bomb on us. There was no obedience happening after the flood. There was just disobedience. So we read that the people of Noah in verse 2 migrate until they find some land that looked acceptable. They come to a place called Shinar, and then we read that they settled there. And in verse 3 and 4 here, I think the story gets very interesting. If you're like me and you enjoy irony, pay attention. Moses shifts kind of from giving us this overview, and he zeroes in on the efforts of humanity. The people settle in the land. They say to one another, let us make bricks so we can establish ourselves, so we can begin to build houses. And then someone, one person, gets a bright idea. And he starts telling it to his friends and his family. And this idea kind of spreads through the camp. It spreads through these people that have descended from Noah. And in verse 4, Moses tells us what it is. They say, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower. And if we stop there, maybe we're okay." But they said, "With its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." They decide that they want to build a tower to heaven, a tower that stretches into heaven. They have an ambition of autonomy. See, here's the important thing to remember, friends. This is not just a tall tale. This is a historical event. This is set in history. These people build a 300-foot-high temple called the Ziggurat of Marduk of Babylon. If you Google that, you can find pictures, artist renderings of what it might have looked like, because we've only found the remains. But see, these people believe that they can build this tower into the heavens, and what they're saying there is, we want to have access to God. If we build our tower high enough, we can use it like a staircase, and we can ascend into the realm of the divine. And their thought process is, if we do this, if we build this tower, we'll have fame and immortality. We will have a name for ourselves. We will be known throughout the world because we have reached the divine, and essentially they're saying we will become like God. Do you see the connection between Genesis 11 and Genesis 3? Do you see how these stories have interacted? Last week I said that the devil is kind of lame because he really has no new strategies. Friends, man is lame because we have no new ideas. Genesis 11 and Genesis 3 are connected because of idolatry and pride. The people here in Genesis 11, they want to be known. They want to be famous. They want to be like God. They end up repeating the exact same sins as Adam and Eve. Why did Adam and Eve eat the fruit? Because they were told that with it would come the knowledge that would make them like God. They believed that had they eaten it, they would be divine. And so they pridefully took it and ate. And look what Moses writes in verse 5. Moses writes, "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built." Here's the irony. What were they trying to accomplish when they started building a 300-foot-high tower? They wanted to reach the heavens. They wanted to reach the realm of the divine. They wanted to ascend up to where God lived. They wanted to reach the throne room of God. And what does Moses tell us? "And the Lord came down." In other words, he's saying they weren't even close. God couldn't see it. God had to come down to investigate what was happening. Moses is essentially making fun of man here. He's making fun of the puniness of man. Here we want to try and elevate ourselves to this idea of divinity. We want to be known. We want to be like God. And what does God have to do to even understand what's going on? He comes down. Now, of course, God doesn't really have to come down to see the tower. God is everywhere. God knows all. God sees all. God has decreed all. But he comes down. And what does he call them? He says, which the children of man had built. In the Hebrew language, the word for man is Adam. So every time you said Adam, you were really speaking Hebrew and you just didn't know it. The word for man is Adam. And so you could translate that phrase, children of man, you really could switch it up and you could say that the Lord came down to see the tower which the sons of Adam had built. The Lord recognizes that they've repeated the sins of Adam. One author I read this week said this about this tower. He said, this tower is so far from being in heaven, God can't see it from heaven. But when you want to show the ludicrous nature of man's God belittling pride in his little achievements, you take some risks, you speak with irony, and you describe God as peering down in search of this great tower with his tops to the heavens. God belittling pride, that's the same sin of Adam and Eve. And God recognizes that here and calls them the sons of Adam. And what's God's response? Look at verse 6. And the Lord said, behold, they're one people and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. The Lord recognizes what's happening. They haven't dispersed. They haven't spread out. They've been disobedient. They have one language. And he says, look, now, whatever they propose to do, it will not be impossible for them to do it. And what he's saying is this. He's saying that when man has the ability to communicate flawlessly, sin can run rampant. There's a curse here in Genesis 11 that is placed on man. And it is only until recently that we've begun to see this curse lifted. See, God returns here to a much gentler approach to his sinful creatures. Look at verse 7. It says, come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. His response here is similar to that of the garden in comparison to his response to Noah's generation. In the garden, there was a curse and man was cast out. You read in Genesis 3, Adam is cast out to work the ground, and God tells him, look, no longer is the ground going to just spring forth vegetation, but you're going to toil over it, you're going to sweat, you're going to have to work, thorns and thistles are going to come up to try to choke out your vegetation. It's going to be tough, Adam, but you can live. In Genesis 9, Genesis 8, and Genesis 7, God sees the wickedness of man. He somehow chooses in his knowledge and his wisdom and his glory and his grace, he chooses Noah for some reason to save, and he curses the rest of mankind. He judges the rest of humanity righteously, and he sends a flood to destroy everything. And now we get his response here again is a much gentler approach. Friends, our God is a God who keeps his word. Do you remember what happened after the flood? After the flood, God puts a rainbow in the sky and he makes a covenant with Noah and with humanity that he would never again strike down every living creature on the earth. And two chapters later, you have man again trying to overstep his boundary. You have man again trying to elevate himself to divinity. You have man again repeating the sins of Adam. And God's response is to remember his covenant with Noah, remember his words that he spoke, and he doesn't kill every living creature like he has every right to. Instead, his response is to confuse the language of man and to scatter them. I don't know about you, but I'm thankful that God keeps his words. I am thankful that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So God confuses their language. We read that they're scattered in verse 8. And here's some more irony for you. Do you remember why they wanted to build the city in the first place? What was their motivation behind building a city and a tower that reached to heaven? They wanted to be known, but even before that, they wanted to not be dispersed. We read in verse 2 that they came to the lands of Shinar and they settled there. They didn't want to live a nomadic lifestyle. So they decided to settle, to be one. They decided to build a tower that would be unifying, that they would all be well known. And what happens at the end of all of this? Look at verse 9. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. At the end of all of this, at the end of all their puny attempts to create a name for themselves, to remain stationed in one spot, they are dispersed at the end of this, they are scattered at the end of this, and instead of being unified behind their tower, they are in disarray. It gets to the point where they don't even know what each other's saying, and so they just drop their tools that they're working with. They just walk away from the tower. They just give up. They're not unified. They're scattered. I started out by saying that I think this passage of Scripture is often overlooked, but that it plays an important role really in the story of the Bible. And we learn something amazing really about God and his will. And that's this. God's will cannot be prevented by man's sin. God's will cannot be prevented by man's sin. See, God has decreed all things that happen in history, and nothing can hinder or stop that. What was the commandment to Adam and Eve? What was the commandment to Noah? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. That was God's will. That was God's decreed plan for the world, for humanity. And man stepped in and they said, you know what, God, like that sounds good, but we would rather be unified. We would rather be together. We would rather be made famous and be like you. So we're going to do this. And God says, well, guess what? My will still happens. My plan is still carried forth because I not only know those things, I decreed all things. Friends, God's knowledge comes from God's decree. God does not take in knowledge. He decrees all things, and that's how he knows all things. And so God says, my will, my plan cannot be prevented because of your sin. And there might be some of you wondering why God would allow these men to sin if he decreed all things. I had a conversation last week after we talked about Genesis 3, and the question was, why would God put the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the garden in the first place? Why would God allow these men to build the tower in the first place? Why would he decree it for them? And see, the Bible tells us that God has a purpose behind everything, that God has a will and a plan for everything. And as you go through this year, the more you read through the Bible, the more you will see that God uses the sins of man to really not only fulfill his will, but to accomplish his purposes. And so it's kind of just to drive this home at the time, When we're going through things that are rough, when we're going through tough times, when we're going through sinful moments, we might not know why God has permitted that sin to take place. We might not understand why God has decreed that sin to take place. See, often, it's in those times that we're in the middle of the storm, that we're right in the thick of things, and it isn't until we are out of it that we see the rainbow, that we see why it happened. I've told the story in here before of my father passing away when I was 14. At the time, I had no idea why he would allow that to take place. But here I am, 15 years later, and I can look back on that and say, God accomplished his purpose through that. God has placed me here because of that. God has given me two beautiful children and a beautiful wife because of that. When we're in the middle of the storm, it isn't until we're out of it that we see the rainbow, but do not forget that God is glorified in all of it, and I think we see here how God is glorified in the Tower of Babel. Last week I said we have the unique perspective of looking back on the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament. In doing that, we realize that first and foremost, when this is all said and done, when history as we know it comes to a close, Jesus will bring every tribe, tongue, and nation under his reign and rule. When he goes to the cross for the sins of his sheep, when he dies a death that we deserve, being sons of Adam, being sinful sons and daughters of Adam, it included not only the Jews, but also the Gentiles, which is me and you. It wasn't just Abraham. It was also all the nations that came out of the Tower of Babel. Not only that, but it gives us hope in the success of the Great Commission. Jesus tells us to go to all the nations and make disciples of them. The reason for that commission is a direct result of the Tower of Babel. All nations are reached because Jesus has been given all authority, as he says in Matthew 28, on heaven and in earth. Revelation 5, 9 through 10 says this, and they, angels, sang a new song saying, worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. They're singing to Jesus. For you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God. And they shall reign on the earth. What started as the result of sins of the sons of Adam results in the glorification of the sons of Jesus and the daughters of Jesus. He sets up a kingdom. Subsequently here, I would say that the diversity of language hinders the rise of a global anti-Christian state. John Piper said this, we often think that the diversity of languages and cultures and peoples and political states is a hindrance to world evangelization. There we go. My mind just went blank. The spread of God's glory. We often look at the world, and we say, how can I spread the message? I don't know German. I don't know French. I don't know Spanish. I don't know Hindi. I don't know Farsi. And we see it as a hindrance. And John Piper says that it's not the way that God sees it. God is more concerned about the dangers of human uniformity here than he is about human diversity. We humans are far too evil to be allowed to unite in one language or one government. The gospel of the glory of Christ spreads better and flourishes more because of the 6,500 languages, not just in spite of it. The Tower of Babel gives us hope. The Tower of Babel shows us that there is someone who is in control and that his will not be prevented by our sin. And so friends, today I just encourage you to rejoice in that truth. That there is nothing you can do to thwart God's plans. There is nothing you can do to confuse God, to surprise God. But that God uses our sins to bring himself glory. Let's pray. Father, I just thank you for today, Lord. I thank you for this time where we're able to gather together as a church body, sing praises to you, read your word. And we do so not because we want to make a name for ourselves, but we do so because we want to glorify you. So Lord, right now I just pray for everyone here. Lord, I ask that you would work in their lives, that you would move amongst us, that you would encourage us, that you would convict us of sin. Lord, and I pray for those that are here that are going through a tough time, that are maybe going through a sinful period or just a period of hurt. They're just caught up in the storms of life and they don't know why. Lord, I ask that you would comfort them. Lord, that they would read the story of the Tower of Babel, that they'd read the story of Noah. And that they would know that this isn't a surprise to you, that what happens in history isn't a surprise, that you don't gain knowledge, Father, but that you've decreed all things that have come to pass. That there's a purpose behind everything, and while we might not know it in the moment, while we might not know it 10 years from now or 20 years from now, or even while we're still on this earth, but that we know that ultimately you are glorified in what happens. And that when history comes to its summation, that you would stand victorious over sin and death, that you will stand and seat on the throne, and that we will glorify you and sing praises to you and look back on things of this earth and say, Father, you glorified yourself. You are amazing. You are loving. You are gracious and merciful. So be with us today, Father. Allow us to go into the world and to speak to every tribe, tongue, nation, and people, and to proclaim the goodness of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. It's in your name.